From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Marty Moscowane. On today's Fresh Air, meet crime writer James Ellroy. He sets his novels in 1950s Los Angeles, where he grew up. When Ellroy was just 10 years old, his mother was brutally murdered. He says his mother's death, to this day unsolved, led him to a career in crime writing. Also, we'll talk with Maxine Cumin, the poet laureate of New Hampshire. Her latest collection of essays and stories is about living on her New England horse farm. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of pianist Maria Tipo playing the music of Muzio Clementi. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Federal Reserve Board has raised two key interest rates by half a percentage point. Steve Beckner of Market News Service reports.
The Fed raised its discount rate at which it lends to banks from 3.5% to 4%. More importantly, it hiked the federal funds rate at which banks borrow from each other overnight from 4.5% to 4.75%. The funds rate sets the tone for other short-term interest rates, and markets wasted no time pushing them up across the board. Led by Chase Manhattan, banks raised their prime lending rate 0.5% to 7.75%. But long-term interest rates fell as inflation-wary investors bid up bond prices. The Fed said it took the action to curb inflation in the face of rising rates of resource utilization in an expanding economy. It said the rate hikes, the fifth this year, should be sufficient for a time, but analysts see further rate hikes by year-end. Congressional Democrats blasted the Fed, but the White House was supportive. This is Steve Beckner in Washington.
The Senate is getting ready for a kind of showdown on health care reform. Republicans are considering allowing the first votes on Majority Leader George Mitchell's reform plan. Republican senators are still making opening statements on reform, even though debate has been going on for a week. Majority Leader George Mitchell has threatened to keep the Senate in continuous session if the GOP won't stop talking and allow the voting to begin. Republican Senator Don Nichols of Oklahoma says the GOP is not filibustering health care reform, but he says Republicans are prepared to meet Mitchell's threat.
We feel like this is a very important issue. Most of us, I know many of us have made speeches. No one is filibustered that I know of. Most of the speeches are 30 minutes in length. Some of us have gone a little bit longer than that. But our strategy right now is really to find out what's in the bill.
Democratic senators say the Republicans are stalling for time. Washington Senator Patty Murray says the Republicans need to stop talking and start voting.
It is time to move on. It is time to get to the amendment process, and it's time to make a difference for thousands and thousands of Americans in this country. It's time to get on with this long-winded debate, Mr. President, because frankly, it's become more painful than my last six-hour wait in the emergency room.
Meanwhile, a bipartisan group of a little more than 20 senators is preparing a compromise that could scale back the Mitchell bill benefits. A violent storm has struck South Carolina. Authorities say a possible tornado has hit downtown Lexington. An unknown number of people have been trapped in a shopping center. A county spokeswoman says a shelter has been set up to help the injured, and a local hospital says emergency workers expect at least 20 people to be treated. There's no word of serious injuries or deaths. The State Highway Patrol has closed all highways into the Lexington area, which is just west of Columbus, the state capital. On Wall Street, the Dow was up more than 24 points at 3784. This is NPR. The reputed terrorist Carlos has been arraigned in a Paris courtroom. He's been formally charged with engineering a fatal bombing there in 1982. It killed one and wounded 63 people, but it is one of the lesser crimes he's believed to have masterminded. Carlos will be charged later with the 1975 shooting deaths of two French counterintelligence agents, but he's already been sentenced to life in prison for those murders. Carlos appeared upbeat today in the courtroom. He talked about guns with his escorts and casually greeted the judge. German authorities have arrested a man who was trying to sell plutonium. This is the fourth seizure of weapons-grade nuclear material in Germany in the last 4 months. NPR's Dieter Berger reports from Frankfurt.
Police in the northern German town of Bremen have confirmed the arrest of a 35-year-old man last Friday who sold undercover agents 2 grams of plutonium. The man, who police say is from Schwerin in eastern Germany, told agents he could provide 70 more grams. According to police, experts say the sample is not warhead-grade quality. Prosecutors suspect the plutonium comes from a Russian research institute. This past weekend, Munich officials confiscated a much larger find of plutonium that three men tried to smuggle to Germany on a Lufthansa flight from Moscow. A German government envoy is scheduled to go to Moscow this weekend to discuss security surrounding nuclear material. I'm Dieter Berger in Frankfurt.
Tropical storm Beryl has been downgraded to a tropical depression. Forecasters say Beryl is losing strength as it lumbers north from Florida into southwest Georgia. The National Weather Service says there's still a flood warning in a limited area where 3 to 5 inches of rain have fallen. Flood watches, tornado watches, and high wind advisories are in effect over a much wider area. The government says the housing industry recovered a little last month. The Commerce Department says housing starts jumped 4.7% in July. This comes after June's drop of more than 9%. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. What would lead someone to write gritty, savage, and cynical tales of crime? James Ellroy says it all began when he was 10 years old and learned that his mother had been brutally murdered. In the more than 3 decades since her death, the murder remains unsolved. For Ellroy, those 30 years have included a life of petty crime, alcoholism, and homelessness. And in the last 15 years, a successful career as a writer of darkly drawn crime novels. Ellroy has said that he writes about psychologically flawed people with bad character traits, caught up in bad situations during historical times when political correctness didn't exist. His books include The Black Dahlia, White Jazz, L.A. Confidential, and his latest, a collection of short stories called Hollywood Nocturnes. Ellroy has now turned to nonfiction. The current issue of GQ magazine features an article he wrote about his mother's murder. I wanted to know why he's now going back over the details of the case.
A friend of mine, a reporter named Frank Gerardo of the San Gabriel Valley Tribune, was doing a piece on celebrated or semi-celebrated San Gabriel Valley homicides that went unsolved. He became acquainted with two remarkable men, Sergeants Bill Stoner and Sergeant Bill McComas of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department's Unsolved Unit. The mandate of the Unsolved Unit is to periodically review unsolved homicide with an eye towards assessing where the initial investigating officers screwed up. As soon as I had heard that Frank Gerardo heard the file, I realized that I had to see it and write a piece about it. So I went to my good friend and colleague, the editor at GQ, Paul Scanlon, and said, Paul, let me write this piece. I want to go out, I want to talk to Bill Stoner, and I want to see the pictures of my mother dead, and I want to read all the paperwork that has accrued since 1958.
But why now did you want to involve yourself deeper in the story of her murder?
Basically, right off the bat, for publicity.
Really?
Yes.
Why?
Yes. Because I'm a publicity fiend. I am the Dracula. I am the Frankenstein. I'm the Wolfman of publicity. And I realized that it would be a salutary confrontation.
Nothing deeper than that? I mean, I know that certainly the murder of one's parents, especially a young age, has got to be something that stays with someone their whole life. There was nothing deeper than just
salutary confrontation. That was it. Yeah. I have exploited my mother. I have exploited her murder over the course of many book tours.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted the woman to speak to me more than me speaking once again about her. Now, parenthetically, an earlier book of mine, my novel, The Black Dahlia, this is the story of the 1947 murder of a young woman named Elizabeth Short. This is a murder that is as celebrated as my mother's was publicly neglected. When I went touring for that book in 1987, I saw that there was a very simple cause and effect that even the stupidest journalist on earth could glom onto. A young woman is killed in 1947. The killing goes unsolved. The mother of a young man is killed in 1958. The boy is 10. He becomes obsessed with the Black Dahlia murder case as a way of touching the horror of his own mother's death without getting terribly scalded by the flames. I realized that that was a basic truth, and I realized it was one that I could exploit. But, well, you know, exploitation can only go so far, and exploitation exacts a toll. and I think I wanted to confront the toll that it had taken on me when I wrote the piece for GQ.
So you felt like you owed your mother something.
Yes.
Well, take for us, if you can, back to the late 50s, and tell us what was known at that time about how your mother was murdered.
My mother, Geneva Hilliker Elroy, was an alcoholic. She was promiscuous. She was divorced from my father. She worked as a registered nurse at an electronics plant in Santa Monica, California. She up and moved us 6 months prior to her death to a small crumb-bum town called El Monte in the San Gabriel Valley, east of Los Angeles. I spent the weekends with my father. I spent the weeks with my mother. I spent the weekend of June 21st and 22nd with my father in Hollywood. He brought me back on the bus on the afternoon of Sunday the 22nd. When I got to the house where I lived with my mother, cops were all over the place, and they said, "Son, your mother's been killed. Where's your father?" And they rounded him up at the bus depot. He was waiting to go back to Hollywood. Of course, he couldn't have done it. He was with me at the time of my mother's death.
He was a suspect, though?
He was the initial suspect, right. And he was dismissed very rapidly. What happened was this. My mother went out drinking in a bar in El Monte on the evening of Saturday, June 21st, 1958. Man picked her up, strangled her, dumped her body into some bushes adjoining a Royal High School, and the killing was never solved.
Now, when you had a chance to look in her file when you went to Los Angeles, what did you find in there that interested you in particular?
More than anything else, I saw a milieu, and a milieu of loneliness. Middle-aged people going to a bar on a Saturday night, getting bombed, and having or not having backseat or backroom assignations, maybe going into alcoholic blackouts, you know, certainly telling themselves and telling each other, you know, a good many lies. And the pathos of it all, the sadness, was really enough to make you gone in the stomach.
Did you see pictures of her body in her file?
Yes, I did.
What did they look like?
She was strangled, she was clothed, and she was dumped into some bushes, as I said, adjoining the football field at a Royal High School. As I say in the piece in GQ, lividity had thickened her features. She didn't quite look like my mother. I realize that throughout the years I've idealized my mother's appearance. There were a number of snapshots of her. I have no snapshots of her. I do now, since I've written the GQ piece. I realized that I had idealized her appearance. I had made her look younger and softer and prettier. She was a boozer. She was a smoker. It showed on her face. She was 43 at the time of her death and looked somewhat older than that.
Hmm.
I saw that the toll that the life that she was living exacted on her.
And the effect on you to look at these pictures that, of course, you hadn't seen in more than 30 years.
I hadn't seen the pictures ever.
Ever.
Yeah.
I mean, the effect on you to see your mother's dead body, what was that?
It was saddening. It was somewhat shocking. My reaction to it was delayed. I'm a professional. I was in a room with half a dozen other men at the time I saw the pictures. I certainly wasn't going to break down and do a boo-hoo number.
Mm-hmm.
It had a belated effect on me, and it's had a cumulative effect on me, and as you may have noted at the end of the piece in GQ, I am going to write a book about my mother,
right,
and her homicide. And what I am going to do is the following. This fall, Bill Stoner and I, Bill Stoner, the head of the L.A. Sheriff's Department's Unsolved Unit, is now retired. He's a very brilliant detective and one of the most amazing people that I've ever met. He's the man that solved the Cotton Club homicide in the late 1980s. He and I are going to reopen the case ourselves and actively investigate it from here till the end of the earth.
Hmm.
And our investigation will be the dramatic basis of my book.
There's a picture of you in the GQ article, and it's a picture, at least as you write, taken by a news photographer shortly after you are told that your mother is dead.
Right.
He apparently posed you in a workshop or a garage nearby.
Mm-hmm.
And there you are, looking out at the camera with a little tool in your hand over a piece of wood. It looks almost like something out of a yearbook from the 1950s. Now, I don't know what a 10-year-old is supposed to look like after they've just heard that their mother is murdered. But I looked at that picture and I couldn't read you. I didn't know what was going on for you.
I comment on that very thing that you have noticed in the course of the GQ piece. My grief was instantaneously compromised. I love my father much more than my mother. He was easier on me. He was much more accessible. He wasn't an alcoholic. He was certainly promiscuous, but he hid his promiscuity from me, unlike my mother. And at the time of my mother's death, I was not loving her too much. And some dim reptile part of my brain seized upon the fact that, wow, now I can go live with my father, which was something I dearly wanted to do.
You talk about reopening this case and taking it as far as it will go. Of course, the idea of trying to find out who murdered your mother. If you were to find that person, have you thought about what effect that might have on you?
If Stoner and I find the man, we will attempt to bring him to justice. This is not as far-fetched a notion as you might think. Stoner has solved a number of these long-dormant homicides. Things like this do happen. The man my mother left the bar with was in his early 40s in 1958. So he's 78, 79, 81, or 2 years old now. He may well be dead. I don't know what the actuarial tables would say about something like that. If he's still alive, we're going to attempt to find him. There may well be people who are around then who had strong suspicions that weren't questioned by the police. There is an established procedure for finding out these things, and nobody knows it better than Bill Stoner.
Do you think your skills as a crime novelist will help you in tracking down the murder of your mother?
I think I understand the inner logic of homicide investigations. And one of the first things that Stoner and I are going to be doing this fall is examining my mock-up of what I think we should be doing. I'm very curious to run this by him and see how much of this is the established procedure. Because the thing about writing crime fiction is this. As good as it is, as socially potent as it can be, as well as it can illustrate American society, most of it is rebop, shuck, and jive. I tell lies for a living. Stoner unearthed truths for 33 years of his life as a deputy sheriff. I want to hit right on the snout the fiction-fact dichotomy. I want to hit it on the snout with a big nail-studded 2x4. I want to dig as far into myself as I can, as far as I can into Stoner, his life story, my life story, the story of my mother from her birth in Tunnel City, Wisconsin in April of 1915 to her death in El Monte, California in June of 1958.
Well, you seem to imply in the GQ article that if your mother hadn't been murdered, you would not be a writer of crime fiction. Is that true?
The die was cast. I was a big reader already, but as soon as my mother died, my reading focused centered on true life accounts of crime, true life accounts of psychosexual behavior. I had an inexhaustible and perverse curiosity for anything pertaining to crime, crime fiction, kids' crime fiction, graduating into adult crime fiction.
Well, I want to talk more, but first we're going to take a very short break. And my guest on Fresh Air is James Elroy. He's a writer of crime fiction. He has a new book out called Hollywood Nocturnes. He also has a piece in the August edition of GQ magazine about his mother's murder, which happened when he was 10 years old. We'll be back after a very short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Elroy. He writes crime detective novels, or crime fiction, and his latest book is called Hollywood Nocturnes, and he also has a piece in the August edition of GQ about his mother's murder. I want to just pick up on some of the strands of your life before we get back to the kind of writing you've done and how the pieces of your mother's real-life murder have shown up in some of your novels. But after she died, I know that you went to live with your father, and as you said, this was something that you really wanted to do.
Yes.
What was it like to live with him, and how different was that from living with your mother?
It was very, very different. My mother and my father shared one thing, and that was a love of the flesh. She liked men. He liked women. They did not hide this lust of theirs under a bushel. They were horned out sex fiends, you know, from the gate.
And you knew that as a kid?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it was obvious.
Yeah. The great story about my father is this, and he was a tremendous, tremendous liar and fabricator and a you-know-what artist that we can't say on the air. When I was about 14 years old, he said, you know, Jimmy, I used to go to bed with Rita Hayworth. And I said, Dad, you lie. You lie like a rug. You didn't go to bed with Rita Hayworth. He said, yeah, I did. I had an affair with her in the late 1940s, around the time you were born. So I forgot about it. About 10 years after my father's death, in 1965, I saw a biography of Rita Hayworth in a bookstore window in Los Angeles. And I went in and looked up my father's name in the index. And, oh, yeah, he was her business manager in the late 1940s.
So there was...
It's possibility.
Possibility.
Yeah, and I hope it's true.
Well, his dying words to you, I understand, were, son, try to pick up every waitress who serves you.
Yes.
He wanted you to carry on the family legacy.
The legacy I fulfilled with, you know, mixed results, to say the least.
But you did carry it on.
I tried.
Well, I understand that living with your father, you started shoplifting. Is that right? Or had that started earlier?
I went to live with my father in this pad south of Hollywood, cheap pad. We had a beagle dog who was unhousebroken. The place stunk to high heavens. My father used to hang out in the backyard of our apartment building in his boxer shorts and laugh when nothing was funny and watch the fights on TV and earn just enough money to support the two of us, i.e. three hots and a cot. And I was always sticking my snout in a book. I was walking the dog. I was prowling around with the dog late at night and looking in windows and watching women undress. And as I got older, I started shoplifting. I started swimming trunks, hang ten swimming trunks.
What? That was one of the things you went after?
Yeah, because I sold them to the kids at high school. Yeah, I stole them from Mattson's department store on Hollywood Boulevard in Los Angeles.
How would you do that?
Well, I'd take five or six pairs, you know, into the men's room. There, you know, the dressing room, and try them on. And I was a big, rangy, skinny kid, and I'd pull my pants on top of them and put two pairs back on the rack and walk out with several and sell them.
And after that, what other kinds of things would you steal?
I would steal anything that wasn't nailed down. My father would give me $20 to go to the store. I would steal the food that he wanted, if I could, and bring him back change from a tin. Things like this.
Did you ever get caught when you were young?
Yeah, many, many times.
And what was the punishment?
Many, many times. Oh. Well, as I got older, I started doing county jail time for shoplifting, for drunk driving, for burglary. I used to break into houses and sniff women's undergarments.
Really?
Yeah. I was a panty sniffer.
I mean, you went in with that purpose in mind?
Yeah, yeah. I was a little freak, fetishist, misanthropic geek. I mean, I was about 6'3 and 140 pounds, and 50 pounds of it was zits. And I was an acquired taste that nobody ever acquired. I was in love with a girl from my neighborhood. I grew up right on the edge of Hancock Park in Los Angeles, which was quite waspy and wealthy. And I was in love with a girl named Kathy Montgomery. And I used to break into her pad all the time and raid her weed stash and steal things out of the icebox and raid her lingerie drawer.
So were you scared when you did this?
Yeah, but it was a thrill.
But you liked that?
Yeah, yeah, I dug it. And all my books, to one degree or another, feature burglary. And it's a thrill. It's one of the big thrills. I would not rate burglary up there with writing crime fiction, self-publicity, or sex, but it's got to be fourth or fifth.
Yeah. I understand.
And I haven't done it in a number of years, too.
Yeah. Do you miss it?
No. I am the world's squarest, most happily married, devoted husband and dog, you know, on earth. I just did a bunch of crazy stuff while I was a kid.
Right. You still a voyeur, though?
No.
I mean voyeur in the way...
I'm very, very curious about people in their lives. Yeah, right. I'm curious, you know, especially about their sexuality. And I put it out there on the page. Mm. I don't have to look in windows.
You started drinking around 1964?
Right.
So you were about 15 years old?
I was 16 and 64.
Yeah. I mean, was this just drinking with the guys kind of thing, or?
I didn't have any friends back then. I was bopping down the street one day in the summer of 1963, and I was 15. And my options were go to a movie, go to the library, get a book, buy a book, steal a book, ride around on my bicycle, ride out to the beach, go to Pacific Ocean Park or something. And a little voice said, get drunk. So I hot-footed it down to this place called Liquor and Food Mart at the corner of Beverly and St. Andrews in Los Angeles, near where I lived. And I boosted a bottle of Taylor New York State Champagne. And I took it back up to Robert Burns Park on the corner of Beverly and Van Ness. And I popped a cork and hit myself right in the eye, and it hurt. And I guzzled the bottle. And I exposed myself to a girl named Michelle, who I'd been in love with for many years.
After you drank?
Yeah, and chased her around the park in that condition. And the next thing I knew, I woke up, and I was at home on my bed, and my father was looking down at me, and he was saying, you're going to be a bleep, bleep drunk just like your mother. And he was right.
Wow.
So I went into a big blackout the first time I got drunk.
So, and as I understand, having read a little bit about your life, I mean, you really went down that road.
Yeah, I got kicked out of high school in 65. I enlisted in the Army. I faked a nervous breakdown. I got kicked out of the Army. I came back to L.A. I went crazy until I got sober in 1977. I did county jail time. Not the big house. And I mean, only for 10 and 15 and 20 and 45 days at a pop. And I got sober when I was 29 and started writing books.
What do you remember from that time at all? Much of anything?
I'll tell you. It was awful. I was always terrified. I was always in some sort of depressed or hopped up state. I was ravaged by guilt and doubt and terrible emotions. Looking back on it now, it almost seems picaresque to me. I can regale my wife for hours at a time of my preposterous, moronic misadventures between the years of 1964 and 1977. I mean, Helen will just howl. She howls like a hyena when I tell her some of the stupid things that I did.
But as
it's stupid and pathetic.
Yeah. So you got sober in 77. How did you do that?
I got sober.
I mean, you just decided the hell with this?
Yeah. Yeah.
And was that hard?
Yeah. But I wanted it. I wanted to have a life. I wanted to be with women. I wanted to write books.
What, though, had changed to get you to that point that you wanted?
It was over. I knew it. I knew it. I couldn't run from myself any longer.
So, I mean, did you go to group meetings? Or I mean,
I went to AA. If I were still going to AA, I would not violate my anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films, which is one of the key traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Right.
But I went to AA for about 5 years.
And you found it helpful?
Yeah. Yeah, it saved my life.
So do you miss drinking at all?
No. No. I don't miss drinking. I don't miss, using drugs. I don't miss being broke. I don't miss, going to jail. I don't miss sleeping in parks. Mm-hmm. I don't miss being sick all the time. I have a great life. Yeah. The piece in GQ, you may think that it's dark. You may even think that it's morose. But I am probably the most transcendently happy and fulfilled human being that I know.
James Ellroy writes crime novels. His latest is a collection of short stories called Hollywood Nocturnes. His article about his mother's murder is in this month's GQ. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Coming up, women, animals, and vegetables. Poet Maxine Kuman owns a farm in New Hampshire and divides her time between raising horses and writing poetry. Kuman received the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 1973, and she's currently the Poet Laureate of New Hampshire. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD from Maria Tipo, playing the piano sonatas of Muzio Clementi. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton has suspended his public fight for a crime bill for a day. Instead, he's in private meetings with lawmakers to see if he can turn the tide. NPR's Mara Liasson reports from the White House.
After 4 days of asking the American public to join him in the fight for a bill that includes 60 new death penalties, life in prison for three-time felons, and a ban on assault weapons, President Clinton changed his tactics. He met in private today with lawmakers such as Louisiana Democrat Cleo Fields. Fields is one of the 10 members of the Congressional Black Caucus who voted to block the crime bill last week. Now Fields says he might switch.
There's a strong possibility I may vote for the rule if I feel a little bit more confident and more comfortable about how we deal with capital punishment.
White House officials say they're hopeful they can get the votes of three or four Black Caucus members, but they're still a handful of votes away from the number they need. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell says if Republicans don't let the Senate vote on amendments to his health care bill tonight, he'll keep the chamber in continuous session. That means Republicans would have to debate the measure without any break at all. GOP senators are complaining they're being rushed on the most important bill in a quarter century. But Democrats say Republicans should shut up and start allowing votes. Tropical storm Beryl has been downgraded to a tropical depression. Weather forecasters say it's taking the same path across Florida and Georgia as tropical storm Alberto did 6 weeks ago. Sid Hoskinson of Peach State Public Radio has this report.
Beryl is pelting portions of South Georgia already devastated by floods caused by tropical storm Alberto last month. In Albany, where thousands of people were left homeless when the Flint River overflowed its banks, weary residents are keeping a close watch on this storm system. But Albany Disaster Coordinator Jim Bramble says it is not nearly as dangerous as Alberto.
If the storm will pass over within the next 4 or 5 hours, the majority of the rain will be to the east of us, and I don't really see it affecting the Flint River that much.
Alberto killed more than 30 people in Georgia, and damage estimates from that storm are said to approach $1 billion. For National Public Radio, I'm Sid Hoskinson in Atlanta.
United Airlines says it will hire more than 1,700 workers by the end of the year. The announcement comes less than a month since United's employees took majority ownership of the air carrier. United's new chairman says cost control is still a top priority, but he says staffing shortages have made it hard for customers to get the service they expect, and that threatens revenues. Most of the new workers will be in the reservations division. New pilots and flight attendants will also be hired. On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 24 points to end at 3,784. Advances led declines by a margin of 4-3. This is NPR. A new study finds major earthquakes are now less deadly but more expensive than they used to be. Researchers at Stanford University say earlier estimates overestimated the number of people who die in earthquakes, but they also underestimate the economic cost. One example, a severe earthquake like the one that hit San Francisco in 1906 might kill 6,000 people today. That's compared to an earlier estimate of 11,000 people. But the new study also says the quake would cost $135 billion. The earlier prediction was only a cost of $38 billion. French authorities have lodged a new charge against reputed terrorist Carlos. He's blamed for a series of hijackings, bombings, and assassinations over 20 years. He's now accused of masterminding a Paris bombing 12 years ago. The BBC's Stephen Jessel reports from the French capital.
Although one of his lawyers is reported to have claimed that his client was drugged and abducted from Sudan in exchange for a cash payment, Carlos himself seemed in relaxed form this morning. As he climbed the spiral staircase to the office of the examining magistrate, Jean-Louis Bruguière, he chatted to his five police guards about their weapons, saying he'd used the same model in the Lebanon. Then, on meeting the judge, he asked him how he was, and when asked the same question back, replied, alive and for a long time. He told one of his guards that the judge, France's most prominent examining magistrate in the field of terrorism, was a star. The questioning dealt with a bomb attack in 1982 against an Arab newspaper in a street just off the Champs-Élysées, an explosion which killed one person and injured 63 others.
The BBC's Stephen Jessel reporting. The UN Special Envoy to Bosnia says lifting the arms embargo against the Bosnian government could be helpful. But Envoy Thorvald Stoltenberg says it must be done as the result of a UN Security Council decision and not unilaterally. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In the early 60s, the poet Maxine Kuman and her family fell in love with a fallen-down, overgrown 200-acre farm in central New Hampshire. After lovingly restoring the house and barn, they moved in the late 70s and made it their home. Kuman was raised in Philadelphia and was living in Boston at the time. Maxine Kuman is also a novelist and essayist. Her writing is inspired by her life in the country, tending her garden and breeding horses. Women, Animals, and Vegetables is the title of her newest book. It's a collection of essays and stories about her intense relationship to the natural world around her. Here's Maxine Kuman reading from the opening of her new collection. It's a poem called The Word.
We ride up softly to the hidden oval in the woods, a plateau rimmed with wavy stands of gray birch and white pine, my horse thinking his thoughts happy in the October dapple, and I thinking mine and his, which is my prerogative, both of us just in time to see a big doe loft up over the four-foot fence, her white scut catching the sun and then releasing it, soundlessly clapping our reveries shut. The pine grove shivers as she passes, the red squirrels thrill, announcing her departure. Come back, I want to call to her, we who mean you no harm, come back and show us who stand pinned in stopped time to the track, how you can go from a standing start up and over. We on our side, pulses racing, are synchronized with your racing heart. I want to tell her, watch me mornings when I fill the cylinders with sunflower seeds. See how the chickadees and lesser red-breasted nuthatches crowd onto my arm, permitting me briefly to stand in for a tree. And how the vixen in the bottom meadow I ride across allows me under cover of horse scent to observe the education of her kits, how they dive for the burrow on command, how they reemerge at another word she uses, a word I am searching for. Its sound is O-shaped and unencumbered, the see-through color of river, airy as the topmost evergreen fingers, and soft as pine duff underfoot where the doe lies down out of sight. Take me in. Tell me the word.
What does country life offer you then as a writer?
Well, it isn't just as a writer. As a writer, of course, it offers me a great deal. It's been my place. It's been the source of inspiration and a lot of hard work. But it's just the lifestyle. It's knowing that you can open the door and put your feet out on ground. I mean, I am horrified by the thought of living in, let's say, an apartment in a high rise and having to go down in elevators and out into traffic. I just am a country person all the way, and I'm a little bit of a recluse, although I think my family knows this better than the outside world. It's a standing joke in the family that you can't get me past the mailbox unless it's on a horse or behind a horse. So it gives me that kind of contemplative time.
You write that stormy days are the best writing days. Mm-hmm. Why so?
Well, because I don't have that that other compulsion to go and do something useful with a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old or something like that, and I feel justified in spending leisurely hours thinking things through, perhaps picking my way through some failed worksheets of poems and so on.
But do you feel torn between your animals and your writing?
I frequently feel torn between them, yes.
Feeling that if you're writing, you should be riding,
exactly.
And if you're writing, you should be writing?
Exactly. This is the fate of the Calvinist.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, salvation through grace and grace through good works. And so one is always looking about for evidence of good works, whether it's clean stalls and scrubbed out water buckets or answered correspondence or a structured draft of a new work.
So are you marked as a Calvinist?
I'm afraid I am a Jewish agnostic Calvinist to the core.
How did that happen?
I guess it was bred into me. I'm not sure. People frequently ask me why I'm so addicted to horses, and I have no answer for that either.
Well, I was going to ask you that exact question because I certainly have people in my family who love horses with all their heart. Did you ride horses before you moved to New Hampshire?
Yes, I rode as a youngster on those, you know, sad old school horses that livery stables rent out, and I was only permitted to ride once a week. But I made up for it by spending hanging out at the stable every possible moment and learning to clean harness and learning how to clean out stalls and learning how to groom and all of those other things. I always used to say that had my parents gratified my adolescent desires and yearnings for horses, I might have gotten over it and turned into a normal adult.
Well, what are those desires about, though?
I think to be the custodian of these creatures and to live in a situation where you can constantly observe them. It isn't so much the actual physical riding or driving, although certainly I enjoy that, but I get an enormous amount of pleasure and insight just in observing my horses at liberty. I mean, you know, until you've seen two horses relate to each other and stand there grooming each other, until you've seen them bucketing around when the wind comes up and they're feeling really good, you just haven't appreciated the aesthetics of the horse.
More from Maxine Cumin in a few moments. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer and poet Maxine Cumin. When did you begin to write poetry?
I think I started to write poetry as soon as I could read and write, about age, 7 or 8.
What did you write about?
Well, I think the first poem I ever wrote was a little piece about a robin. Can it be that spring is here? It started. It was very imitative.
Do you remember the rest of it?
Can it be that spring is here? Hark, oh, what is that I hear? It cannot be, but yes, it is the robin's cheer.
So you were writing about nature from the
get-go? Yes, I was. Isn't that amazing? It's surprising looking back. I went through I wrote my way through grammar school, junior high school. Then I pretty much stopped writing in college because it was not really looked on with favor at the time that I was an undergraduate. You were there to amass learning, not to create. And I went back to the writing of poetry shortly after I was married, but I was very much a closet poet for a long time. I had 3 kids before I returned openly, overtly, and seriously to the writing of serious poems.
Well, I understand that a professor at Radcliffe, where you went to college, said to you after you gave him some poems to read, quote, "Say it with flowers, for God's sake. Don't try to write poems about it." Is that true?
That's true. I was 17 years old. I was devastated by that. I did find out later that he pretty routinely said that to young women who dared to hand him sheafs of poems. I'm sure that the comment was richly deserved because they were very romantic and very imitative. And it probably didn't do me any harm as a poet to have a period of long dormancy. By the time I returned to writing poetry, I was really ready for a kind of a new education and a new outlook.
So do you think he did you a favor, even if that wasn't his intention?
Very possibly a backhanded favor. I wouldn't recommend it, however, to anybody who's listening and teaching.
Well, you've taught it at a number of universities. How have you either encouraged or maybe discouraged aspiring poets?
Well, I try not to discourage because I don't think anybody knows what a 17 or 18-year-old is going to be capable of 3 or 4 years down the road. I think that anything you can say or do to encourage creative thinking and creative writing is really a requirement of being a good teacher.
You described yourself as a closet poet for many years. Does that mean you rarely showed your poems, or?
Right. I didn't show them at all for many years. It was a secret activity.
Do you know why?
I think I was embarrassed to be writing poems. I think I felt it was a little bit outré. It was frowned on. It wasn't an acceptable activity.
Did your parents know you wrote poetry?
Well, I don't think my parents spent much time thinking about it. They knew that I was a sort of intellectual, or as they were known in those days, a brain trust.
That's the phrase?
That was the phrase that I was, yes, tagged with.
Well, you say that as if that's a terrible thing to be.
Well, I don't think so at all. I think it's a wonderful thing to be. But at the time, in my peer group, it was not a wonderful thing to be.
Does that mean you had to hide your brain power?
It was better to be
power?
A cheerleader.
Oh, did you aspire to that?
I didn't really aspire to cheerleading because I thought it was not possible for me. And so I, you know, went out for the school paper and that sort of thing.
But did you feel you had to keep your brain trust hidden?
I did, in order to maintain any status at all in the peer group. And I think kids face that all the time.
There's another quote, and this is a rather provocative one that has been ascribed to you, that behind you apparently said, behind every writer stands an unhappy childhood.
I did say that, and it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek because I think that all writers tend to look back on their childhood as a period of intense dissatisfaction, if not morbid unhappiness. Otherwise, they probably wouldn't be writers. There has to be an enormous gift for introspection in the person who writes. I spoke a little nostalgically and longingly about wishing I could have been a cheerleader. And had I been a cheerleader, I certainly wouldn't have been writing poems in the dark, as it were.
So where were you between dissatisfaction and morbid unhappiness?
Probably right in the middle.
Uh-huh. So what happened that you moved from the closet poet, as you describe yourself, to a published and very well-regarded poet?
Well, I joined a poetry workshop at the Boston Center for Adult Education, which was run by John Holmes, who was a poet and professor at Tufts, and early on became my mentor. And under his hired sympathy, I was able to develop as a poet.
And be able to say your work out loud and hope for a publisher?
Yes, all of those things. Actually, after I think a year or two at the Boston Center, a few of us splintered off, Ann Sexton, George Starbuck, Sam Albert, John Holmes, and me, and we had our own poetry workshop for many years. We met in one another's houses every other week from about 58 till 1962.
Wow. And you read each other's
work? We read each other's work. We commented, we criticized, we attacked, we praised, we drank, we were noisy. My kids used to say, oh, you're having company, who's coming? And I'd say, no, it's just the workshop. And they would groan and say, oh, not the poets. Can we go sleep in the room over the garage? Meaning it was going to be so noisy, they wouldn't be able to sleep.
Does that mean you argued about poetry?
We did. We fought passionately about it.
About
and then there
what?
Would be angry exchanges of letters the next day, back and forth, saying, I think George talked too much, I think Anne hogged the stage, etc.
So how did this help you all as poets?
I think it helped enormously. We all got a book out of it. I mean, we were all writing a book at that time, even though we didn't realize it, perhaps.
When you're asked that question, well, what do you do? What do you say?
Well, I usually say, well, we have a farm and we raise horses. I don't usually admit I'm a poet.
Why not?
Well, because if you say you're a poet, the next question invariably is, oh, have you ever published anything? you know, it's if you said you were a lawyer, they wouldn't ask you if you'd ever tried a case. If you said you were a doctor, then your credentials would absolutely speak for themselves. But to say you're a poet is kind of a self-styled vocation, and therefore it's a little bit suspect.
Maxine Cumin, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
My pleasure.
Maxine Cumin is poet laureate of New Hampshire. She won a Pulitzer for her poetry back in 1973. Her latest book is entitled Women, Animals, and Vegetables. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Noah, what news do you have on the financial front for us?
Hi, Marty. The Federal Reserve Board has decided to increase some short-term interest rates. In response, the big lenders are increasing their prime lending rate. Other stories, Michael Scholar talks with us about the efforts to encourage Hutu refugees to return to Rwanda, but he tells us many Tutsis are starting to move into some Hutu properties there. Ina Jaffe reports on the California Senate race, Michael Huffington running against the incumbent, Dianne Feinstein. And I'll talk with the author of a new biography about Hank Williams. We'll hear about the country singer's tragic final car trip.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The classical composer Muzio Clementi is called the father of the pianoforte. He not only wrote for the piano and played the piano, he also built and sold pianos. The Italian pianist Maria Tipo has a new recording of Clementi sonatas, and classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
Among the great composers for the keyboard between Bach and Chopin, one of the least familiar is Muzio Clementi. He's probably better known for his series of 100 piano exercises, Gradus ad Parnassum, Steps to Parnassus, than for his 100 piano sonatas. Yet these sonatas really consolidated the form as we know it. Clementi's life and music span both the classical and romantic periods, and most of Europe. He was born in Rome 4 years before Mozart. As a teenage prodigy, he was taken to England by an English patron. He made a fortune as a virtuoso, then made, lost, and remade other fortunes publishing music and manufacturing pianos. He knew both Haydn and Beethoven, who thought highly of him, and he was obviously influenced by Scarlatti, his most immediate major predecessor. He died at 80 when Chopin was 22. In various ways, his music resembles all the composers he overlapped. Yet finally, his combination of elegance and gravity is distinctively his own. This passage from his Opus 13, No. 6 in F minor actually uses a phrase from a Scarlatti sonata in the same key.
Thank you.
was 28, Clementi engaged in a famous competition with Mozart in Vienna, arranged by Emperor Joseph II. The 24-year-old Mozart was impressed with Clementi's technique, but contemptuous of what he regarded as empty brilliance. Though later, in his overture to the Magic Flute, Mozart used a theme from one of the sonatas that Clementi played on that occasion. Clementi, meanwhile, praised the singing style of Mozart's playing, to which he credited a radical change in his own style. His melodic pathos can be heard in the four sonatas on this new disc, three of which are in a minor key. Clementi couldn't have a more sympathetic advocate than Maria Tipo, who was especially admired for her Bach, Scarlatti, and Mozart. Her feathery, multicolored, perfumed touch brings a certain sensuousness to music that in other hands can sound a little dry. Tipo has an almost vocal freedom, an operatic, very Italian style of playing. Clementi told one of his pupils that he learned a great deal from listening to famous singers. Tipo's fingers really sing, like Mozart's, and as Clementi's own fingers evidently learned to do.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Maria Tipo playing Clementi piano sonatas on EMI Classics. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Richard Parker, and Dan Lachlan. Abby Beshkin is our intern. Sue Spolin directed today's show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moskowain.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In 1985, Fleet Maul was sentenced to 25 years in prison for drug smuggling. On the next Fresh Air, Maul tells us about the spiritual life he found behind prison walls and his hospice work with dying inmates. I'm Marty Moskowain, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.